Green Acres is the place to be. Farm living is the life for me. Land spreading out so far and wide. Keep Manhattan, just give me that countryside.
Give me Park Avenue.
The chores.
The stores.
Fresh air.
Times Square.
You are my wife.
Goodbye, city life.
Green Acres, we are there.
All right, Brandon, how do I say your name? Is it Sheard, as in herd?
It's Sheared.
Sheared.
As in the past tense of sheer. I don't know.
Okay, that's perfect. Hey, brother, thank you so much for joining us. Glad to have you. I see the first thing that I notice about this, you have a Korean de Soccer Corps flag, and there's only one place you could have gotten it from, and that's me.
It's very likely. I think there's I think Tumblr House also puts them out, too.
Do they?
Yeah.
Well, I think Tumblr House probably buys them from us.
There you go.
But anyway, what's the one directly behind you? What is that?
So I am told it is the battle flag of the Vendée.
There it is. Wow. Now, I should know that because I have a daily devotion to the Vendée. Nice little studio set up there. Folks, we are so thrilled and honored to have Brandon. And you're going to find out why by the end of the program here. But why don't we start at the top? Tell people who you are and how you got started or how you got interested in livestock and butchering.
Yeah, so I'm Brandon Sheard, and my wife and I, right after we met, sort of discovered that we could attain a degree of health by simply eating well, because God is good, and food could be good for you and taste nice at the same time. And I was working at a grocery store chain, kind of getting into alternative medicine, and I thought health came in capsules for a while, and pills, special pills. And when I found that I could just probably eat some raw beef, and that would actually taste much better and be better for me, that was kind of a revelation. So We started going down that journey and found that the closer we got to growing our own food and raising it, the better everything tasted and the more healthy we were. And so that was kind of the initiation of it. And I say it became our calling when people started calling us on the phone, literally, to come harvest their animals and to do local slaughter and butchery. So to this day, I have a mobile slaughter truck, and I go around and I slaughter animals on farm, bring them back to my shop, which I'm currently building here, and we butcher them with zero waste. So there's no trim, there's no waste bin. Everything the animal produces is delicious and wonderful if you know how to use it. And so it was honestly, I just wanted to do that for my family. And people have been kind enough to allow me to start a business doing that as well, so that we can make our own bacon and eat pretty well.
Now, how long ago was this? Give me a year.
This was 12 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, this was about 10 years ago. And I grew up in complete, suburban upbringing. I was in academia. I lived off of chips and salsa and Trader Joe's wine. That was it. And then one day I worked at a farm, and basically it was right after we got married, and my 2 week vacation for our honeymoon was actually my 2 weeks notice for the current job I had then. And I went into the little town that we lived on door to door, and a butcher shop had opened the day before. And I went in and I saw that, hey, they're making their own wine. I like wine. That's cool. And I basically showed up there for 2 weeks until they started paying me. And that was my first butchery farm experience. And it was when I tasted the bacon that we made there and the real food that we produced that I was like, what is this other stuff that I have been eating my whole life and would dare to feed to my children? This is not right. This is disorder.
So 12 years ago, so you actually went to a butcher shop. Now, I want to give people the full impression of what a drastic change in life this was for you. What did you actually go to school and pay all those dollars and all those years to do? Where do you hear this?
Yeah, so I have a master's degree in English Renaissance literature.
Yeah. I mean, it's perfect. It makes you a perfect butcher and a homeschooler.
There you go. There you go. Yeah, I mean, I don't regret it. I have to say it was my taste for good literature, man. Reading Milton and Shakespeare, and that it just hones your aesthetic sense. And so much of what we do is settle for garbage, especially in the way that we eat and prepare food.
And, of course, now, if you read good English literature, then that means that you were reading Chesterton and Belloc. Had it ever occurred to you while you were reading this that the 3 acres and a farm, the 3 acres of farm and a cow was actually something to aspire to?
You know, it was, unfortunately, I was a Protestant then. We're converts. And so I missed out on Chesterton and Belloc. It was heavy emphasis on John Milton, the arch Protestant of the time. And he did have one line speaking about the difference in Samson Agonistes between strenuous liberty and bondage with ease, which applies to a lot of things, especially food making.
Okay, so we weren't going to talk about your conversion, but when did you convert? And you went first, or did you marry a Catholic and then you converted?
We converted together. We married as Protestants. And honestly, our move to the land, our desire to grow food was pretty much simultaneous with our conversion to the Catholic Church. We had kind of been wallowing in the disembodied cerebral, you know, world of Protestant practice of the faith. You know, it's all about what you believe. It's very heady. Mm. And so when we discovered what the Eucharist actually was, that was part of a full-scale revolution in our own lives. It was a whole – that changed everything, really.
Well, you know, and I don't believe that that's coincidental, because I'm sure you've read the books now from Father McNabb and Father Fahey and others here, The Church and the Land, the Catholic and the Farm.
Yeah.
He has it right, there, Father Fahey's book. This is not coincidental. And, you know, at the start of the as the Industrial Revolution began to rear its ugly head, you know, the Pope started writing about what danger lie ahead. And it got so bad to the point after World War II, Pope Pius XII actually gave an address to the Italian farmers. Well, you know it because it's in the book. And he pleaded with them, please, go, gentlemen, go back to the land. The industrial guys are coming. And it's not going to turn out well. All right, we got a good start here with Brandon Sheard, and let's periodically give people how they can get in touch with you, because I suspect you're going to be a very popular man this afternoon. Where would you like them to go to contact you?
Yeah, so check out farmsteadmeatsmith.com is our website. We're on Instagram and other places. We have a podcast called the Meatsmith Harvest. That my wife and I put out a lot, and it's very much oriented towards, it's really an assertion of delight in the domestic scale, in the family scale of food production and growing, and just ordered family life.
Okay, so farmsteadmeatsmith.com. It kind of has a ring to it. Any story behind Farmstead Meatsmith?
I mean, yeah, you know, other than. It was just that all the other terms seemed insufficient, because so much of our meat processing is compartmentalized and fragmented into many different steps, especially on the industrial scale. And they're all centralized and disastrous. But you can actually do all of it. So, you know, it could be a slaughterman, a butcher, a charcutier, a curer, and a cook in the, you know, at the family table, in the home kitchen. That's the housewife,
right?
Or the husband. They do all of it. And so meat smith was a word that Lauren made up. My wife came up with that to describe that.
I bet there are a lot of people out there that are going to be setting their sights now on becoming meat smiths. Watch. All right, let's start at the top here, Brandon. Just walk us through maybe some butchering 101, stuff that everybody needs to know, even if it's just like, all right, I'm going to try this. I'm just going to go get one chicken. Butchering 101, where do we start?
Yeah, I think it's fortunately, it is very simple. You got to remember that you have the prowess to do this, even if you have zero experience. I have zero training in butchery and slaughter, none. But what I did learn how to do, which is what so essential, is I learned how to cook meat. Because the thing about butchery is that the thing is not about butchery, it's about cooking.
Hmm.
Butchery is a means to that end.
Ah.
And I would sooner trust an adept housewife that knows how to cook with the butchery of my cow than a conventional grocery store butcher. She knows the end. And so she knows she can get there. And so I always tell people, learn how to braise, pan fry, and roast. Those are the only three recipes for every single piece of animal protein you can extract from a creature. If you can braise, pan fry, and roast, then you know how to cook it. And if you know how to cook it, then you have animated your will to actually desire it, which means you'll figure out how to harvest that animal, how to do a good kill, and how to part it out. So, I mean, you just can't underestimate how important it is to learn how to cook. That's step one. And then step two is get yourself a very sharp knife.
Here in Louisiana, we get this from our French ancestors. We have these contraptions that we call a knife filet. You want a filet blade, which is long and skinny, but it's long and it's got a little curve to it. Is that that's essential? Everybody's got to have a filet knife.
I would say, yeah, even then, you know, the shape is irrelevant. It is all about sharpness. And that is the thing that people seldom experience. So we forget that it exists. Because if you're sitting in front of a carcass on your kitchen table, which I highly recommend, and you can figure out how to get chops from that thing. You can do it. It's not that complex. But if your knife is dull, you can't. You'll go to make a cut. And instead of what you envision happening, your nefarious tool that's working against you won't do that. And then you'll start to think, oh, butchery is too complex. This is hard. It's like, no. Your knife is dull. That's the problem. It should slide effortlessly through meat. That's sharpness is highly underestimated. Even butchers today use dull knives.
Now, do you have a preferred method? Do you use a stone? Do you have one of those gizmos that has the two blades that come together and you just slide it through it?
No jigs. No angle finders.
No.
The Japanese have established a knife sharpening dogma.
Okay.
They got it. We don't need to debate it anymore. So it's water stones. King water stones. It's just two wet stones, a coarse and a fine. And it's all that sharpness is acuteness as opposed to obtuseness. That's all it is. Super acute. And all of our knives are really obtuse because in America, at least, we sharpen them for durability rather than cutting.
So King Waterstones, one coarse, one fine.
Yeah.
So I imagine you start with the coarse and you're trying to get some, and then the fine to actually really, really get a point on it.
That's right. The coarse is where you're removing steel to get that acute geometry. And then the fine is just to polish away the grooves that the coarser stone made on the edge. So it's not a serrated edge, it's more polished, much sharper.
Okay, we're with Brandon Sheard, Farmstead Meatsmith. It's farmsteadmeatsmith.com here on Free Farm Friday. I subtitled this, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Butchering But Was Afraid to Ask. Let's talk about what we don't want. And, you know, I just read this awesome piece about how the communists came, when communists come in, and we have them here in the U.S., they want to make everything standardized, which is why we have only one variety of beef today in the supermarket. Primarily, it's called Black Angus beef. And this kind of standardization completely eliminates the diversity. And I was also reading in this article that in the United Kingdom, in every single county, and I've been to like 30 of them, Yorkshire, Berkshire, what have you, they have a different breed of livestock everywhere you go. We don't have that here. So the first thing, you know, we already learned here today before you came on is diversity. Are you starting to, do you see diversity now? You're in Idaho. Where are you at?
I'm in Oklahoma.
Oklahoma. Hey, good. He's driving distance, guys. All right, Oklahoma. Are you seeing any diversity being reintroduced in your lives, in the livestock that you encounter?
It is only on small family farms.
Okay.
Which is part of... Yeah, it's only on small family farms. And today we definitely fetishize, because we don't know how to cook, the lean and the boneless. And so consequently, we breed all of our livestock to reflect a very fast growth rate, leanness, and insipid, banal, non-flavor. It's just, it's terrible. And that's the standard.
But where you are in the small farms, what are the small farms in Oklahoma doing that those guys aren't doing?
Yeah, so they are looking for things that work for the domestic economy, which is the only real economy. And so that means animals that it's a whole different set of priorities. People get hung up and afraid of harvesting or butchering their own creatures, even raising them, because they take the industrial standards as ones that they need to apply to their home. From killing to cutting and everything, but that is ridiculous. Your standard is, how do I get this creature to fit in my pot, my pan, and my oven? And can I cook it well and make it delicious? And so to that end, that's what all the historical heritage breed livestock are ordered towards, the family kitchen. When you have steel and concrete, you can raise a pig purely as a, you know, protein production unit. But when you have a backyard, you need a docile sweet pig who doesn't want to escape. And who's not going to threaten your kids. And maybe they're kind of cute. Like, cuteness helps on the farm, right? And so you get your Gloucester Old Spot, right? Another region in England. Gloucestershire Old Spot pig. They're the sweetest tempered pig. You can get American Guinea hogs, which are small and oriented towards lard production. That is their specialty. They put on fat, which means they require very little feed. Their metabolism's totally different. And they fit perfectly in the domestic economy. That's where all of the heritage breeds come from. They're all smaller. They all grow a little slower. They all require less intensely protein-rich feed to grow.
So I've done barbecue competitions, pork barbecue competitions. I've roasted whole hogs. And it wasn't until maybe the fifth or sixth year when I even heard, you're just going, I need a pig. I want a whole pig. That I even knew that there was a Duroc, that there was a Berkshire, that there. And I'm trying to think of the third one. But for a whole hog, we found out that the Duroc was best. And then for ribs, we found out that the Berkshire produced a better slab of ribs. So I kind of knew a little bit about it. But you know what? We had to order these things. There was no local farmer was producing Duroc or Berkshire or any of the Gloucester hogs that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Now, so the people that are raising these pigs, around you that you just talked about, is that because you recommended it to them, or did they just organically find this out?
Yeah, I think it's they're finding it out because they're running up against these generational health issues that are, you know, all of these autoimmune disorders and everything. And so a lot of them are just scrambling to like, okay, we got to produce our own meat. This is ridiculous. Just to extract themselves from the degradation that is wrought by centralized processing and food production on their own immune systems, on their own health. And so a lot of these people do find us online, and I've been, you know, through our videos on YouTube and everything, I definitely promote all of the small heritage livestock. And it runs across the board. It's with beef and poultry and geese and everything.
Now, what about the bovine? Now, you do bovine, so we can graduate now to a different kind of livestock. We all know Black Angus, and that's pretty much all we know. But I remember going to Scotland for the first time back in 2013, and having a hamburger at a local restaurant. And I remember all the Americans that were with us complaining about, you know, this is just too lean. It doesn't have any flavor. I was like, I thought it had a lot of flavor to it. What about cows? What kind of varietals of cows are there?
Yeah, there's many. And unfortunately, just like the Angus originally came from Scotland. And just like all these old breeds, they were delicious, they were slower growing, but the moment we plug in a breed to an industrialized farming model, they immediately become flavorless, fast-growing, and too lean. And they thrive only on being finished on corn and soy.
Mm.
And we select for that because the point of the feedlots is not to create good beef. It's actually to get rid of excess corn and soy because it's all subsidized.
Right.
And so you turn your genetics to be a good way to use waste corn and soy, which means your cows don't know how to graze on grass anymore and get fat on grass. Grass fat is crazy delicious. So you have to do this massive search and find old genetics. So, you know, Dexter's or Devon cattle, Red Devon, they were the first cattle be brought to the United States, and the herd still exists in North Carolina. Red Devon cattle. And these are bovines that can survive on low quality forage and get fat and just crazy delicious. And they maintain their ordered physiology. Like bulls that are selected for feedlots lose their masculinity.
Okay.
They actually become less fertile. And they produce poor cows that don't have good reproductive rates, and everything deteriorates from there.
So what was the breed of cow that you said, or Devon, Red Devon?
There's Red Devons, yep. And there's red, let's see, there's South Pole cattle, which is common in our region, actually, which were, they were kind of remade by a modern cow farmer, pulling from old breeds. There's British White, which are beautiful. And then there's Dexters, which are small Scottish cows. There's Scottish Highland cattle. These are all old school breeds that grow a little slower, but they thrive on, you know, weeds, on low quality forage. They don't need the corn and soy to fatten.
So Brandon Sheard is on our Dude Maker Skype line here with us from Farmstead Meatsmith. We're learning a lot about breeds. You know, one of our regular contributors, Dan Mundy, this is his gospel. This is his like religion. Is the restoration of heirloom and naturally occurring livestock, which yeah. He says not only have they been systematically pretty much wiped out. But the land that's necessary for them to live on also has been eliminated in favor of big ag tillage and what have you here. From your experience, Brandon, are you? And by the way, what a great name prior to like 5 months ago. Does anybody come up to you? Let's go, Brandon.
Hey, I'm overwhelmed by the support.
You are overwhelmed by the support. In your experience, are you now seeing, is there an increase that you can actually point to and go like, yeah, it's becoming more accepted, that there are more and more people, not just a bunch of crazed, wacko, trad Catholics, but there are more people that are actually going like, yeah, food supply stinks. I want to get away from this. I want to move out of the city to some place, and I want to try and raise my own meat. Growing? Or just in our heads?
No, I think it's happening, and I think it is growing. And the existence of my business is proof of that. Those are my clientele, and so harvesting, butchering animals for those people. That's how we sustain our family. That's it. And it's definitely growing. Largely, I think, inspired by a lot of these health issues that we're having, that are multi-generational. I mean, the sins of the fathers being visited on the children, in far as what we've been eating, that motivates people.
And do you think that in your experience, again, are people also learning that if you're going to have livestock, you're going to probably want to farm? Because the two, livestock, move, ag, right?
Yeah.
You keep rotating. Are you finding that that is happening?
Yes, definitely. And not a lot for retail. The one thing that is a very slow start is actually small farms producing, wonderful fruits, either meat or vegetable, for sale, such that they can sustain the farm to make an earnest living. That is a rare thing. It's usually always still, you know, just supported by some other stream of income. And so I feel like that's kind of the next challenge, and that's definitely been our perennial challenge. Butchery is easy. Running a small business That is a unique challenge.
Yeah, the small local farm, and again, and this is, we talk about this on Free Farm Friday with our friend Brian Koch and Dan Mundy, our master farmers. This is a thing in people's. This is something that the consumer has to do too. We have to educate them. Yes, you can get it cheaper. Cheaper is not always better. Yes, that chicken may actually cost you 10, 12 bucks for a whole one. That's what it cost. But if you want, and you want someone else to raise it for you and you don't want to do it, well, I think we have to do is educate people better on the health benefits. Now, is that beginning to happen? I know that we try and do it, but we can't always find it. But
yeah.
Education.
Yes. I mean, that's a whole chunk. That's 60% of our business. And that is the only way I can even get customers, because I do this weird thing as a slaughterman and a butcher, is I give them 100% yield. So if you ask me to come harvest your pig, you are getting the trotters, the head, the tail, all the skin, all the fat, all the bones. You're getting the whole thing back. Beautiful, ready to utilize in the kitchen. And you have to have a complete culinary re-education to even want that, to even regard that as anything than an annoying burden. And so until you regard a cleaned, beautiful pig head as an appetizing thing, then, you know, we can't get too far. We can make people feel guilty about it and be like, oh, you should be eating better. Oh, it's destroying the topsoil on the planet. But like, if it doesn't serve your family, if it doesn't taste good in the kitchen, then it's not going to go anywhere. People got to learn how to cook.
So it's just where we get hogshead cheese from?
Yeah, it's so good. It has nothing to do with cheese.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. So when you say if you go to slaughter from someone, now, my ancestral name is Guidry. They came over from France. They settled in New Iberia here in what we call Cajun land in New Acadiana. And I don't know if you've ever been to a real authentic Cajun fait dodo, couchon de lait. They slaughter that pig, and there's nothing. One of the things about the Cajuns, they did what you talk about. They use everything, including the blood. So,
Boudin noir.
Oh, boudin noir. And, you know, there is a revival, I can tell you this here. I even call it now the Boudin Alley. If you're on Interstate 10 or Highway 190 for about 40 miles, you can't swing a dead cat and not hit a sign for a boudin shop. Mm. And there are lines. People are coming from all over now to get boudin. So I think that this is an example here. Boudin is just utilizing what's grown here locally, the peppers, the rice, and then the hog that's raised, and then putting it to use. I want to, enough of me talking, I want to hear you. Give me a book. Give us a book. Re-educators, give us a video course to re-educate me, because I have my own line of rubs and stuff. I would love to be re-educated on my culinary skills. Where do I go? Where do I start?
Yeah, so I have to say, we do have an online membership called the Meatsmith Membership.
Okay.
And it's awesome. It's got a huge archive of over 50 films that I've made, and it details just these traditional peasant processes that, you know, we've had that failure to transmit again. We're not receiving the traditions of our fathers. And when that really is our birthright, all these traditional means of making food, from killing your pig in your backyard or your goose or your lamb, whatever it may be, and then turning it into food in your home and preserving it in a traditional way. So that's all Meatsmith Membership. But one of my favorite authors is definitely, William Cobbett. Probably know about William Cobbett.
I do know of William Cobbett.
Yeah. The Cottage Economy. He wrote The Cottage Economy. Now, the actual title is about three paragraphs long, but that's the first two words, The Cottage Economy. And I think it's open source. But he tells you how to grow your own, have your own garden to be able to keep your own dairy cow, make your own beer, your own pig, and all the vegetables that you need. So it's, you got your bacon, your beer, and your veg.
I'm a happy guy. That's it.
That's all you need. And it's beautiful. And so he's got a whole account of how to do that. And he's writing to cottagers, people who were not big landowners that still had to work a day job. So anyway, there's that Cottage Economy. But then Jane Grigson, I'm a big fan of Jane Grigson. She's a British woman.
Okay.
There were a lot of these in the 60s. Elizabeth David is kind of the preeminent example. Elizabeth Laird is another one. But these were British women that took their families and moved to peasant towns in France, or other countries in Europe, and they actually raise their kids in peasant villages. And they learned how from their neighbors to keep, you know, a mule, to fatten geese, and to raise a pig. And they kind of excavated all these things. And fortunately, they're all British, so they write in the English language, which is the one that I can read. But they're excellent, excellent resources. Jane Grigson.
Okay. What's a membership? What's a Meatsmith membership cost? Go by the year, by the month?
It's you can sign up for a year, which you get a discount, or monthly, and it's $14.50 for a month.
Okay, that's a good deal.
And we do monthly live chats like this, we have a huge forum. We are amassing such an amazing cache of this archival knowledge of tradition. Like, there's even there's a foie gras farmer in your neck of the woods.
Wait a minute,
foie gras in Louisiana.
Maggie, do you remember his name? Somebody mentioned the guy who was the foie gras dude. I've had him mentioned to me. I want to say he's in the
Backwater foie gras.
That's it, Backwater foie gras.
He's a member, so we got a lot of good stuff on.
Okay, well, I received an email from a listener who told me yesterday. He thanked me for having you on, and he said he's in a Facebook group, and he said that there are 5,000 people in that group. 5,000 in the group. I'm not sure if you run the group, but he said he let everyone know. He passed the link out so they could listen and watch today. There is definitely something that is happening here. Now, people that don't know Brandon Sheard but have been to your site probably have the same question that I have, so I hope I'm representing a lot of people here. What are those bird-like critters that you have hanging from clotheslines in your backyard? That you are freshly butchered, because that ain't no chicken that I've ever seen. What are those things?
Oh, man, I got to see the photo you're talking about. It could be rabbits. We raise rabbits.
It looks like a bird.
Okay. Then we've raised Muscovy ducks.
Okay.
Which are a different species than all the other domesticated fowl that we have. Domesticated waterfowl ducks. They are an Amazonian duck. They're very common. And they have the skill of reproduction.
Muscovy duck.
So you get on Craigslist, get yourself a Muscovy hen, and she is your incubator for all the other birds on your farm. She will sit on eggs all day, and if you have a Muscovy drake, she will hatch several hatches a year. They are incredibly prolific. So it's probably Muscovy duck.
And is it a good eating duck? Is it a red meat, flesh meat, or is it a white meat?
It is all dark. It's a red meat duck. The breasts are very steak-like. They're very delicious. It's a little on the lean side, but they're wonderful. They're very calm. They do fly. They have flight. So they won't leave, but they'll fly a couple of loops around your property and land.
Okay, tell me about rabbits. Now, you know, everyone thinks, oh, he's such a cute little rabbit. I went to France. I was actually in the Vendée. I went to Chavagne, which is the capital of the Vendée. And I'd say I was there for 10 days. I'd say 5 days I had rabbit. Oh. They eat a lot of rabbit and a lot of duck. Very little chicken. A lot of rabbit, a lot of duck, a lot of hog. Yeah. Tell the folks about rabbit. How hard is it to raise rabbits? Is it easy? Is it difficult? Do they really multiply like bunnies? What should people know about if they want to try rabbits?
Yes, you have to eat them or they will take over. That's how quickly they multiply.
You have to eat them or they'll take over. I love it.
Yeah, I think it's 35-day gestation, and they can be impregnated immediately after kindling. So you can just have constant rabbit. And the cool thing about rabbits is that they eat the color green. So you don't need to buy feed for your rabbits. When we keep rabbits, it's literally we weed the garden every day. I'll even grow a couple crops for them. Just, you know, anything that is green. I mean, they eat conifer branches. And my son's job is to stuff the cages full of the color green every day, and the rabbits eat themselves through that. And you're turning weeds into protein. So they're incredible in that way.
Now, one of the sisters that we have, Sister Maria Therese up at the St. Benedict Center in New Hampshire, they do some rabbit raising. She says that they get the fertilizer for a lot of their agriculture that they grow from the rabbits. So do you want to put red? Do you want to? I'm not sure how she does it. I guess you put them on a screen and elevate them. Is that the case?
Yeah, there's really two ways to raise it. You can put them in mobile hutches on the ground and drag them on the ground. They get more, and they eat the grass that sticks up through their cage. But they're susceptible to parasites that way. And so you want to make sure you get the right genetics to be able to avoid that. You can also raise them in cages with a perforated bottom so all their poops fall down. And their manure is excellent because it is cool. It's not high in nitrogen, so you don't have to compost it. You can put it directly on your garden. And I would even put it in a 5-gallon bucket and get it wet, let it soak for a little bit, and then just directly on your garden. And it's awesome. Very good for the garden.
So in my backyard, in my development, where we'll be moving from here directly, we've made friends with a lot of rabbits. I see the poop all over the place. And at first, I was trying to keep them away. And then I figured, if this is true, I should just actually start throwing lettuce scraps near the tomatoes and hoping that the rabbits may go, wow, that was really good. I think I'm going to hang out here for a little bit.
Yeah.
Talk about chickens. Everyone wants chickens and eggs. Any tips for the people doing chickens? And are you one of those that thinks or that promotes that? And I know there's or two schools here that, well, if you're going to do chickens and you're just going to do them for eggs, you're only doing half the thing, that you should do them for eggs and for meat. But again, and just hearing you talk, people need to get over, I guess, and I'd be one of them. My wife would be one of them, over the squeamishness of, oh, I don't want to have to kill Loretta. Well, Loretta's going to make a hell of a gumbo.
She is. And you got to think about it, too. It is, it's a matter of justice, because the thing about Loretta is that the worst thing for her is to die of natural causes. She's not going to come up and tell you that her internals are dissolving. But that's what's happening when she's getting old. And it is extraordinarily painful and horrible. The best thing for her is your judicious and decisive slaughter, and then to put her in the pot. And make sure she tastes good. Because what poor thanks is it to cook a bland, dry, rubbery old hen and for it not to taste good? Mm. It's like, come on. So you got to learn how to do your coq au vin, how to cook an old hen well. In gratitude for Loretta. She did good. She should taste nice.
Now, would you call it coq au vin?
Yes, yeah. So it's usually from a cock. You know, you use an old rooster and you marinate it in red wine. You part it out and you marinate it in red wine. And then you slowly braise it in red wine with chunks of bacon, your carrots, onions, and celery. It's crazy delicious.
So the three things are just some things we can review here with Brandon Sheard. You need to learn to braise, pan fry, and roast.
That's it.
Well, I do the last two all the time, like a pro.
Yeah.
Braising, now describe, when you say braising, people like me maybe go, oh, you mean basting. When you say braising, this is obviously a French term. What is this method? Is it just with liquid?
Yeah. Yes, it is. And it's a good point, because it is the single most powerful method as far as making more parts of the carcass available to your kitchen. You can technically braise the entire animal and it'll be good. So the toughest, it's for the toughest cuts of meat. It's for those muscles, bones, and sinews that get the most use as the animal walks around, ergo being very hard to chew.
Right.
So you got to put them in your heavy pot with a lid, and you put wine and stock, or, you know, milk and cider, whatever. It's liquid. And you cook it low and slow with just a simmer. Doesn't even have to be fully submerged. Crock pots have kind of supplanted our braising art in recent history, because it's a little easier. You just plug in and turn around and leave. But you need to get a heavy cast iron pot and braise things in liquid low and slow. It's wonderful.
And it does work. And one of the things that I do for prime ribs or something, a big heavy red meat from time to time, is something that is a takeoff on this, is what we call a Marchand de Vin sauce, which sounds to me like if I was braising a big sinewy, chewy roast, that'd be perfect, because I'd already be cooking it in the red wine, and I'd already have everything I would need then in the pot once I take the meat out to make my Marchand de Vin, right?
Exactly. You have a ready-made sauce. It's instant. It's right there at the end of the cooking process, and it's rich and delicious. And you could even go further and, like, strain it and then reduce it and get yourself a demi-glace, and now you have a nice sauce to serve with the tender meat.
Okay, so I promised Brandon I'll only keep him for 40, 45 minutes, and I'm about out of time. Tell us, what is the strangest beast you have prepared for dinner?
Oh, man.
What's the most exotic, strangest thing that you've been asked or that you raised or whatever and prepared to eat and ate it?
Yeah, it's been pretty tame, I have to confess. It's all the livestock. We eat all the livestock. I've eaten my fair share of roadkill deer. It's wonderful. And, you know, I think on the farm, probably one of the strangest creatures you will encounter is a buck, a male goat who is fully intact. He is a very carnal animal. He is also delicious. So don't let the stench of uric acid and his vulgar behavior deter you from eating him. He is absolutely mild and wonderful. So that's probably as weird as it gets.
Now, what about one of our farmer guys is talking about, he was trying to figure out how much it cost him to raise a dozen eggs. And he did the math, and he goes, it cost me $11. It cost me a dollar an egg almost. So he came to the conclusion, okay, I'm going to stop calculating. I'm just going to eat. But one of the other things that he's wrestling with, and I see some other people, and maybe you have a take on this, or maybe some advice, the coop versus the range. Because I've seen that the range, if only the fittest survive, coop versus range. What say ye?
Yeah. For the domestic scale, you're going to need a coop just for predation. And I think the best coop is one that has a completely enclosed interior space where the laying box are, an exterior run, but that is still enclosed and predator safe.
Okay.
But then a door so you can let them out. To go free range and do their thing and then get them back in. And it gives you that flexibility because you're not farming full time, but you want them to be able to range when they can. And when they can't, you want to be able to keep them in without feeling like they're cooped up, as it were, and miserable.
And if you were advising a complete greenhorn novice and they came to you and said, okay, we want to start with an animal and a small crop, what animal would you suggest that they begin with?
Oh, man, just get all of them.
it all.
Rabbits are excellent because it requires minimal setup. You know, when you go to slaughter your chickens, you got to get your scalding pot out, your defeatherer, like, you know, a lot of equipment. But a rabbit, you can literally wake up in the morning and think, I want to have rabbit tonight, because you can dispatch it with your bare hands. And it's very quick and easy. And you can just feed it your weeds from your garden, and it'll grow and be delicious for you. So I would say start with a rabbit.
And you said 35 days.
I think that's the gestation.
35. Yeah. So
and you can raise them. They're really good at about 8 weeks. They're super tender and young at that age.
Okay.
But, you know, you can let it – the longer they grow, the more flavorsome they become. That's with all livestock. We harvest everything so young. We're used to blandness. But if you let any animal grow, they just get more flavorful.
So the pigs that you grow, like our sister friend, again, she has hogs and she moves them all around 140 acres. And where once they couldn't go, the sisters and the brothers, they can now go. She just fences them in with a solar-powered electric fence. And they eat everything that's not tree.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't need a lawnmower. You need pigs.
Yeah, that's right.
So do you grow your – because she has a pig. How big was that pig? 600 pounds? 600 pounds. And she was – and it was only a year old. It wasn't like it was ancient. She goes, he's only like – four. I don't want to say 14 months old. Yeah. The pigs that you mentioned, though, you said they were small. Tell me what small is.
Yes, so there's two breeds that we commonly have access to that are that way. It's the American Guinea Hog and the Cooney Cooney. And they are small-framed lard pigs, which means their yield is going to be 70% fat. Their body is 70% back fat. And so you would want to raise them if you really know and love back fat, which I do. So we're all into it. But they stay small, you know. After about a year, you know, maybe even 18 months, you'll slaughter them and their hanging weight, so minus guts, will be about 100, 115, 120 pounds. So they stay small, which is nice, which means you're not going to have an 800-pound animal in 15 months, which is very difficult to harvest on the home scale. You'll have something you can manage.
Now, you've mentioned lard a lot. You like lard. Lard is something that people say, oh, that's pig fat. That'll kill you. Obviously, it won't kill you. What else do you use lard for? And if you're going to raise a pig, how do you get the lard out? Do you heat it up? What's the process to get lard?
Lard used to be the point of pigs. That's why we used to raise them. So we could get their lard, because they have a special fat, particularly even on a single pig. There's many great different kinds of fat. There's solid back fat under the skin, which when you grind it, it's diced and not mushed. And that's how you get chunks of beautiful white fat in sausage. That's only the back fat does that. It's the only fat in the cosmos that does that.
Wow.
And you lose that when you don't harvest a pig properly. And then there's internal body fat on a pig, and it's around the kidneys. It's in there with the guts. That's the leaf fat, and that is the epicurean of fat. It's the nobility of fats. It's the purest fat on the pig. It's the original shortening. So hydrogenated vegetable oils, Crisco, those are all bastard imposters for leaf lard, which is so pure. It doesn't have a porky flavor. So you use it as shortening in your pie crusts, and you get the flakiest pie crust in the universe. It is so delicious. And you use it, you know, it's forever supplant canola oil in your kitchen. You can brown steaks in lard. Heck, fry up some bread in lard and then just spread some lard on top of the bread with a little bit of salt, and that'll keep you going for at least 6 hours.
Well, it used to be everything is better with bacon, so everything is better with lard.
Yes.
All right. He is Brandon Sheard, Meatsmith, farmsteadmeatsmith.com. I highly recommend. I'm going to invite you to our Congress that we have in May, because you should come and meet 150 or so people that are all going to want to just they're going to you won't have a spare minute. We've been doing this for a year. This started organically in a small discussion about a raised bed.
Yeah.
And then someone called and goes, oh, we ain't doing the raised bed right. And then somebody else called. And that's how it began. And then it blew into this one. I'm sure you've seen it. Into this thing where now we have guests coming on. I'm going to have my soap lady coming on in 2 weeks.
Excellent.
She had previously come on and told us, you know, they're like you. They live in the middle of nowhere in Washington State. And they raise cows. They take the milk. They use goat's milk for the cheese. She gave us a lesson in cheddaring, which is a process. You think cheddar cheese was just a mold? No, it's an actual process. We've had an aqua.
That is.
What's that?
I bet I know them. I must know them because we just moved from Washington State.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what. I'll send you her email.
Yeah.
And maybe you do know her. But she's going to come on. She does candles, and they raise bees. So she says she's going to come on. She's going to do a show on candles. We had a gentleman, Tracy Stoller, came on and did a show, an entire show on aquaponics.
Yeah.
And he goes, we have all the fish we could ever eat, and we have all the fertilizer we could ever use. And it's just amazing, these little systems, these peasant systems. You said peasant. Peasant systems that they're self-replicating. Self-regenerating. There may be an initial cost to it. Well, certainly land is one of them. Yeah. But it seems to me that the more we learn about this, the more we find out that almost every part of this farming process sustains itself. And of course, it's like Bishop Sheen said, everything cannot be about profit.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why I recommend rabbits for people and pigs, because it is that self-sustaining thing, and you don't need land to raise rabbits and pigs. Backyard. Those are backyard animals.
Backyard animals. How do you like that? All right, yeah. Brandon, truly, let's go, Brandon. Thank you. It's been an enjoyable 45 minutes. How many kids do you and your wife have?
We have 8 children.
Ow. And that's 8 mouths to feed, and you're not stressed out about it at all. You don't have a single wrinkle.
No, if you dare to harvest everything an animal wants to give you, you suffer from the burden of abundance. You have more than you can handle. That's what we have.
I'm going to send people your way, and you're going to see, and I'm going to be one of them. Brandon, thank you. God bless you. Let's do this again soon.
I'm up for it. That'd be great.
And I will send you an invite to the Congress. You're a congressman in this regard. We all want you to be a congressman. He is Brandon Sheard, FarmsteadMeatsmith.com, FarmsteadMeatsmith.com. God bless you and your family. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.